From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, we hear from actor Sidney Poitier, whose classic film In the Heat of the Night is now out on DVD in a special 40th anniversary package. Also, the latest star turn by action movie star Chuck Norris was standing still beside Mike Huckabee after the Iowa caucuses. His old TV series Walker, Texas Ranger was mocked so often on Conan O'Brien's show, Conan had a special lever to activate Norris's clips. All that attention inspired us to go into our archive. Also, film critic David Edelstein has a review of the monster movie Cloverfield, and I'll preview the new TV series Breaking Bad. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for TVWorthWatching.com, sitting in for Terry Gross. In the heat of the night, the landmark movie starring Sidney Poitier as Virgil Tibbs, a Philadelphia homicide detective who investigates a murder in the bigoted Deep South, was re-released on DVD this week in a special 40th anniversary edition. Today on Fresh Air, we hear from Mr. Tibbs himself, Sidney Poitier. In the 1950s and 60s, Poitier starred in a string of films that addressed the racial tensions of the time. Films like The Defiant Ones, Lilies of the Field, Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, and To Sir with Love. In 1963, he became the first African-American to win an Academy Award for Best Actor. Since then, Denzel Washington and Forrest Whitaker also have won Oscars in that same category. Terry Gross spoke to Sidney Poitier in 2000, at the time of the publication of his memoir, The Measure of a Man, a Spiritual Autobiography.
Let me talk with you about a scene from In the Heat of the Night. In that film, Rod Steiger plays a local police chief in a southern town. You're a homicide cop from Philadelphia passing through this southern town, but you're arrested for being suspicious because you're a black man from out of town carrying money in your wallet. The police chief doesn't really believe that you're a cop, so he calls your boss in Philly. And your boss suggests that you stay in this small southern town to help them solve this big murder case that they're working on, because they don't have cops who are nearly as experienced as you are. So in this scene, you and Rod Steiger, who's still very skeptical of you, go to question one of the leading white businessmen in town. And I'll just explain, in case it's confusing as our listeners hear it, that as you're questioning him, the businessman slaps you, and then without missing a beat, you slap him right back. Here's the scene.
Let me understand this. You two came here to question me?
Well, your attitudes, Mr. Endicott, your points of view are a matter of record. Some people, well, let us say the people who work for Mr. Colbert might reasonably regard you as the person least likely to mourn his passing. We were just trying to clarify some of the evidence. Was Mr. Colbert ever in this greenhouse, say, last night about midnight?
Gillespie?
Yeah.
You saw it.
I saw it.
Well, what are you going to do about it?
I don't know.
I'll remember that. There was a time when I could have had you shot.
Sidney Poitier, in your new memoir, you say that's not the way the scene was originally written. Originally, you didn't slap this businessman right after he slapped you. What did you do in the original scene, and why did you want to change it?
The original scene called for the businessman to slap me and for me to absorb it and leave. I found it reprehensible that the writers writing for that period would not have written it differently. And I felt that the natural emotional response to being slapped, as, and I'm speaking not as Sidney Poitier, but I'm speaking as a Philadelphia detective, that the natural response to a man slapping him, he's going to slap him right back. And I elected as an actor to do that because were I the guy from Philadelphia who was slapped, I would slap the guy right back. And I thought that that would be, since those kinds of moments were never found in American films from the inception of films in this country, that kind of a scene, which would be electrifying on the screen, was always either avoided, not thought of, and I insisted that if they wished my participation in the film, that they would have to rewrite it to exemplify that. And it indeed did turn out to be a highlight moment in that film. But it also spoke not just of the two characters, it spoke of our time. It spoke of the time in America when in films, at least, we could step up to certain realities.
Let me advance the story a little further and take you to the early part of your movie career, specifically to Blackboard Jungle, which was released in 1954. This was an important film for you. You had one of the leads in it. This is like the most famous high school film, I think. It opens with Rock Around the Clock. Glenn Ford plays the new teacher at a school just filled with juvenile delinquents. And in your first scene, he catches you and some of the other guys smoking in the bathroom. You're washing your hands with your back turned toward the teacher for most of this scene. Let's hear this scene.
What's your name, wise guy?
Me? Miller. Gregory Miller. You want me to spell it out for you so you won't forget it?
No, you don't have to do that. I'll remember, Miller.
Sure, Chief, you do that.
Or maybe you'd like to take a walk down to the principal's office right now with me. Is that what you want?
You holding all the cards, Chief. You want to take me to see Mr. Warnicky? You do just that.
Who's your home period teacher?
You are, Chief.
Well, why aren't you with the rest of the class?
I already told you. Came in to wash up, Chief.
All right, then wash up. Just cut out that chief routine, you understand?
Sure, Chief. That's what I've been doing all the time. Okay for us to drift now, Chief?
I want to catch you in here again.
Suppose I got business here, Chief.
Look, how many times do I have to tell you? Let's go, huh? Come on, let's go.
Sidney Poitier, how did you like your role in Blackboard Jungle?
I liked it. I liked it. This young guy that I played, he was really on the cusp of finding himself in useful ways or losing himself to forces he couldn't quite understand by then. And so he had some complications. He had some complexities. He had some depth to him. And I liked playing him.
Well, you became the African-American leading man in the 60s. What were some of the things that you felt you weren't allowed to play or express as an African-American leading man in the 60s in Hollywood?
That is a very good question. And the true answer is I have no such imagery of what I was not able to express, because taking the times as they were, the fact of my career was in itself remarkable.
Right.
Just the fact of it, you see. It would have been a luxury I would not have spent much time on trying to determine what was missing. What was missing was not so much for me, but what was missing for the overwhelming majority of other minority actors at the time.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up. What were some of the things you heard from your fellow actors at the time about stereotype roles that they had to play in Hollywood when you came to Hollywood?
Yeah, well, you know, most of us, I think, were obliged to play what was available. I did not. I did not take advantage of that. I couldn't. It was not what I needed to do for my life. I had elected to be the kind of actor whose work would stand as a representation of my values.
Sidney Poitier speaking to Terry Gross in 2000. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2000 interview with Sidney Poitier. One of his groundbreaking films, In the Heat of the Night, has just been re-released on DVD in honor of its 40th anniversary.
Would you describe Cat Island, the island in the Bahamas where you grew up?
It's difficult to describe in that words would be hard to find to convey the beauty of it. You know, we have the most extraordinary beaches in the world. The water is of a color and of a luminance, that is, absolutely striking. And the life was such that you walked everywhere you went, and if you had any heavy loads to carry, you would use a mule or a horse or a donkey and stuff like that.
When you were 10, your family moved to Nassau, I think because there was, what, a crop failure on the island? And...
Well, they were tomato farmers. That's what they, how they earned their living. And they sold to the middle guys in Florida. And they did that for many, many years. And when I was about 9 and a half or so, the U.S. government in Florida, on behalf of the Florida tomato growers, placed an embargo on tomatoes coming out of the Bahamas for reasons, I suppose, beneficial to the local farmers in Florida. But that devastated the whole farming of tomatoes in the Bahamas, throughout the islands in the Bahamas, and especially on Cat Island, which affected my father. And he, having no other means of making a living, had to move the family to Nassau, which was and still is a tourist community and a tourist economy. And he had to find work as best he could somewhere in that new culture.
What kind of work did he find?
Well, not much. He found a job ultimately working for someone in a bicycle store. And he wanted to continue farming, but the soil available was not resilient enough to be useful.
You left for Florida, where your brother was living with his family, when you were age 15. You planned to stay with him. You didn't stay for long. What was it like to face Southern segregation?
Well, it was an experience, I can tell you. There was some semblance of it in Nassau when we moved from Cat Island to Nassau. There was none of it, none, absolutely none of it on Cat Island. I never developed any sense of what color would eventually come to mean in the other parts of the world, and was really unprepared for what I found in Florida at the age of 15.
Did you do things in Florida that were considered terrible mistakes because you didn't understand what segregation meant?
I remember once my brother, with whom I was living once I had arrived there, helped me to get a job within a matter of weeks at Burdine's department store. And at Burdine's department store, I was given a delivery job because I could ride a bicycle, and I used to ride the bicycle from downtown Miami to Miami Beach to deliver packages for the pharmaceutical division of the store. I went to Miami Beach once to take, as a matter of fact, on my first day, to take a package to a home. I had the address, and I went to the address, and I rang the bell, and a lady came to the front door, and she saw me standing there, and I said, good evening, ma'am, and I came to bring you your package. And she slammed the, no, first she said, get her out to the back door. Well, I'm 15 years old. I don't know the rules, and I couldn't understand why I needed to go to the back door, because there she was standing there at the front door, and there I was, smiling with the package in my hand and expecting her to take it. And I said, well, here I am, ma'am, and here's the package. And I handed it to her, and she screamed at me to get around to the back door. So she slammed the door in my face at that point. And still not understanding fully, I decided that the best thing to do is to put the package down on the steps. And I left it there. And I left. And I went home, actually it was 2 days later. I returned from my work at home, and it was in the evening, and the house is dark, and I wondered why there were no lights on in my brother's house. And as I approached the front door, the door opened suddenly, and my sister-in-law grabbed me and pulled me in and pulled me to the floor, where the rest of the family was kind of like huddling. And she said to me, "What did you do?" I said, I didn't do anything. "What do you mean, what did I do?" She says, what happened?" And she explained to me that the Klan had come to the house looking for me. And that was like an introduction, first of all, to the term Klan. I never heard it where I came from. And my curiosity was such that I wondered. I wasn't so much concerned about the Klan because I had no experience and no frame of reference. What I was concerned about was how the effect it had on the family. And stuff like that. There were other instances and incidents in Florida that were representative of the time. You know, America was a different place early 1943.
Your first audition was as a result of a classified ad that you'd read for the American Negro Theater, which was looking for performers. You say when you got to your audition, you had trouble just reading the script. You certainly hadn't been in an audition before. You had no training. But you didn't have much schooling either.
No, I didn't.
How much schooling did you have, and what were your reading skills like at the time?
Well, my schooling, I started school in Nassau at the age of 11, and I had to quit. Actually, I started school at the age of 10 and a half, like 2 weeks after I arrived. And I had to quit at the age of 12 and a half. Because my father was not a man of material means, and therefore every hand in the family needed to lend itself to the family's survival. So I had to go out to get a job, and I did, in fact, get a job at 12 and a half. I suppose that my folks had anticipated my eventually going back to school, but it never happened. So that when I got to New York, I'm able to read, but very, 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 I can't imagine what level, what grade level, but it wasn't terrific. So when I went into this place, I could read, for instance, the want ad pages, and I could recognize words like janitor and dishwasher and stuff like that. Just across the page from the want ad page was the theatrical page, and there was this sign that said Actors Wanted. And I went to this address. I said, maybe I can. I tried dishwashing and janitors and all that stuff. Maybe I'll try this. And I went there, and there was a gentleman there alone in this place. It looked like, it was an empty room with lots of empty chairs and a small, what I've learned was a stage. And he asked me, he said, are you an actor? And I said, yes, I am. He said, where have you acted? I said, in Florida. And he said, okay. He gave me a script and sent me up on this little stage. And he said, turn to page 28. And I did. I read the page and then the following page. And then I said, okay, I'm ready. And he said, okay, you start. I said, all right. And I started reading. Well, of course, I had never read for anyone in my life except maybe in the elementary area in my first year in school in Nassau. So I started out. I said, so where are you going tomorrow? So the chap, I guess his eyes flew open, and he looked up on the stage, and it all came to him, you know, that I was a fake. So he came running up onto the stage, and he snatched the script out of my hand, and he grabbed me. I was a kid, you know, and he spun me around, and he grabbed me by the scruff of the neck and my belt in the back, and he marched me to the door. On the way, he said, these were his words as I remember. He said, get out of here and stop wasting people's time. He said, why don't you go out and get yourself a job you can handle? And as he opened the door and as he chucked me out, his last line to me was, get yourself a job as a dishwasher or something. Well,
why'd you come back for more after that?
Because, as I'm walking down the street, heading to the bus stop to take a bus toward the area where the employment offices were, where I would be going to get a dishwasher's job, I said to myself, how did he know that I was a dishwasher? That's how I made my living in New York City. And I remembered not having told him that I was a dishwasher. So I concluded that he presupposed that that would be my limit. I would fall comfortably in that frame or some such frame. My potential was characterized by his suggestion. And I thought that I cannot let that happen. I would be less than I would like to be if he turned out to have been prophetic when he made that comment. So I decided, as I headed for the bus station, that I was going to become an actor. I was so offended by what he said. And I was going to go back and show him that he was wrong in his assessment of me. That's precisely how it happened.
Well, I thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Sidney Poitier, speaking to Terry Gross in 2000. In the Heat of the Night, in which he starred as Detective Virgil Tibbs, has just been re-released as a special 40th anniversary DVD. I'm David Bean Cooley, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, presenting daily book reviews, author interviews, and more in the Barnes & Noble Review, online at bn.com. From Kauffman, the foundation of entrepreneurship, celebrating entrepreneurs who start businesses and change the world, on the web at kauffman.org. And from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve the health and health care of all Americans, on the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, David Edelstein reviews Cloverfield, a new monster movie shot from the point of view of a person trying not to get stomped. I review the new AMC series Breaking Bad. And from our archive, an interview with the action star who's getting noticed and sometimes mocked for his visibility on the campaign trail, Chuck Norris. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, TV critic for TVWorthWatching.com, sitting in for Terry Gross. Last year, the American Movie Classics Network set out to expand its horizons and begin producing and presenting original, quality television shows. In 2007, AMC presented Robert Duvall in Broken Trail, the best Western miniseries since Lonesome Dove. AMC also presented Mad Men, an ad agency drama set in 1960 that ended up on many TV critics' end-of-year top 10 lists, including mine. And now, this Sunday, comes another boldly against-the-grain, attention-getting offering. This one is called Breaking Bad. It's either a very black comedy or a very twisted, funny drama. After watching 3 episodes, I'm still not sure which. What I am sure about, though, is that Breaking Bad is a new series well worth sampling. It stars Bryan Cranston, the exasperated husband from Malcolm in the Middle, as Walter White. He's a high school chemistry teacher who lives in New Mexico and doesn't exactly have it easy. He moonlights after school at a car wash to help pay the bills, and his wife resells flea market junk on eBay, but that's not enough. They have a teenage son, a good-natured kid with cerebral palsy, and a baby on the way. Walter's wife marks his 50th birthday by presenting him with a special breakfast, a plate of scrambled eggs with the numbers 5-0 spelled out with strips of veggie bacon. Walter might be ripe for a midlife crisis, but he soon learns, as do we, that midlife has long since passed him by. He's diagnosed as having inoperable lung cancer and given 2 years to live, tops. But even before he gets that bad news, he confronts death on a regular basis, in the classroom, during his chemistry lectures.
Chemistry. It is the study of what? Anyone? Ben.
Chemicals.
Chemicals. No. Chemistry is, well, technically, chemistry is the study of matter. But I prefer to see it as the study of change. Now, just think about this. Electrons, they change their energy levels. Molecules change their bonds. Huh? Elements, they combine and change into compounds. Well, that's all of life, right? I mean, it's the constant, it's the cycle, it's solution, dissolution, just over and over and over. It is growth, then decay, then transformation. It is fascinating, really.
When Walter does learn about his cancer, he doesn't tell his wife or anyone else. Instead, he has what might be considered a chemical reaction and begins seething from within. Eventually, he has an inspiration and decides to team up with a local drug dealer and use his scientific expertise to become the biggest crystal meth manufacturer in Albuquerque. When I first heard about Breaking Bad, that was where I grew skeptical. It sounded too much like Weeds, the Showtime comedy starring Mary Louise Parker as a suburban pot dealer. Also, a crystal meth cooker held little interest for me as a dramatic protagonist. But Vince Gilligan, the writer, director, and creator of Breaking Bad, will surprise you if you let him. He did the same thing for years as a writer-producer on The X-Files, including one episode from 1999 which featured Bryan Cranston as the guest star. When Gilligan began writing Breaking Bad, he was sure Cranston could fill the bill, both comically and dramatically. And he does. The two deserve equal credit for pulling off this very improbable trick of a TV series. Cranston gets credit for making Walter sympathetic, even when you know you should be rooting against him. And Gilligan gets credit for confounding expectations at every turn. You know how bad things were for Walter before he decided to provide for his family by cooking up batches of crystal meth? Well, things get so much worse for Walter, and so quickly, that you don't know how or if he's going to escape from the corner he's been painted into. Sunday's premiere episode of Breaking Bad got my attention, and the next two episodes sent for preview won me over, as subplots and supporting characters rose to the surface. Maybe I shouldn't be surprised, since it's a comedy drama about crystal meth, but Breaking Bad already has me hooked. Coming up, the man seen standing behind Mike Huckabee after the Iowa caucus, Chuck Norris. This is Fresh Air. When former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee won the Iowa caucus and gave his victory speech, very visible right behind him was martial arts star Chuck Norris. This happened days before the late-night talk shows returned from the writer's strike. But when they did, all of them noted the prominent presence of the former star of Walker, Texas Ranger. Conan O'Brien went so far as to claim the status of Kingmaker. By playing clips of Norris for years, so often he had a special Walker, Texas Ranger lever installed, O'Brien insists he gave Chuck Norris new life. Norris then endorsed Huckabee and gave him new life. Ergo, Conan O'Brien says, he's responsible for the success of Huckabee. Regardless, we thought we'd hear from Chuck Norris himself, in an interview Terry Gross conducted 20 years ago, 5 years before he starred in his own TV series. But to set the stage, let's hear a clip of Chuck Norris from his signature TV show, the scene that introduced his character of Walker, Texas Ranger.
Beer. You boys are under arrest.
Stuff it, buddy. You got no jurisdiction south of the border. You can't do squat.
Watch me.
I don't think you're getting the meaning of this, buddy. And right now, I see four of us and one of you.
That's about right.
When Terry spoke to Chuck Norris in 1988, she asked him how he became a star in martial arts movies and about his career plans at the time.
When Bruce Lee died, the karate market or the kung fu market in movies died with him. All producers thought, well, since Bruce died, there was no one else that could fulfill that bill. And so when I finally broke in 77, I was known as the kung fu star, in Hollywood or in the media. But I knew that if I was stuck strictly as a kung fu star, that my career would be very limited and I'd never, wouldn't be able to grow. So I started working more into the action orientation of my films with, martial arts or karate integrated into the action. And that way I wouldn't be limited to being strictly a kung fu star, and that's what's worked for me.
What were some of the things that you had to learn in order to broaden into more general action films?
Learning how to act was the main thing. I jumped into the films with absolutely no experience as an actor, had a very little acting classes and so forth, so I had to kind of learn on the job, and it wasn't easy to do that.
Wasn't there a certain amount of acting you have to do to be successful in karate?
No, not acting like you do on the screen, because it's a total different thing. You have to have that drive and determination like an actor does, and you have to, you're performing, but it's on a physical level. But in films, when you're doing scenes over and over again, see, remember when you're fighting, it's spontaneous. But when you do a film, everything is prearranged. You have marks you have to hit. You have to have to do the scenes over and over again, and so it's much more difficult that way.
Well, Steve McQueen, who was a friend of yours and whose son studied at your karate school, gave you some advice on acting. He told you not to verbalize what's already on the screen. Mm-hmm. It almost seems like that became a code for you. I mean, you're really known in your movies as not saying a lot.
Most of your action actors, Stallone, Schwarzenegger, I think all of us kind of stick to that mode. Is that when there's something to say, say it. If it isn't important, then keep your mouth shut, and whether that's right or wrong is up to debate, but, the thing is that we're not Dustin Hoffman, who's got that ability to express in words, and because he can express in words and you can visualize them, but not many actors have that ability to verbally express himself and you can, in your mind, see what he's saying, So the thing is, if you can show it on the screen visually rather than verbally, it's much better.
Let's talk about stunts some more. Now, do you always do your own stunts?
Not all of them. Some I don't do. If it's way out of my range of ability, then, of course, I won't do it. I don't do fire burns, which is really extremely dangerous.
That's what, like you're walking through an exploded bomb or something
right,
like
or,
that?
Or catching on fire.
Uh-huh.
And things like that I wouldn't want to do. There's just certain things, or high dives, and I'm not a high diver, so I have to have a stunt double do that. But anything that requires balance or coordination or a certain amount of strength, then I can do that.
Well, I remember in Code of Silence, there's a great scene in which you're fighting with someone on top of a New York City train.
Right. Yeah, I did
and
that.
And the train is moving. That's you. Mm-hmm. That wasn't a stuntman.
No, I did that.
Now, the train was actually moving while we were doing that, wasn't it?
It was doing about 35 miles an hour. In fact, you know, the thing is, the stuntman that I was fighting with was a little bit apprehensive about me doing that because we were relying on each other to keep our balance on that train because we're 50 feet in the air. That's an L train. We're 50 feet in the air. And he said, I don't know if you should do this or not. I said, well, look, let's do it with the train stopped. If you feel I'm not capable of doing it, then we'll bring in a stunt double. So we did it with the train stopped. And he said, no, no. He says, you'll do okay. So I did the fight with him.
How did you and the stuntman that you were working with keep your balance while the train was moving? What were some of the tricks to doing that?
Well, the tricks is just having the ability to maintain your balance up there. It's, you know, we had the fight prearranged, of course, but we're rolling all over the top of that train. And we're really controlling each other. You know, we're preventing each other from falling off. So we're really balancing each other as we're fighting on top of that train. And you just, you know, either you have the athletic ability to do it or you don't have it.
Now, as you're actually holding on to each other and trying to help each other keep balance, you have to look as if you're fighting each other and trying to throw each other off the top of the train.
Yeah, exactly.
Can you talk a little bit about how you kind of make it seem like you're trying to throw the person off the train while you're really hanging on to them?
Well, it's kind of a hard thing to describe, you know, because you're up there and you're just doing the thing as strong as you can without losing your balance. And a couple times, you know, I broke my balance once, but he controlled it for me, and then he broke his balance once, and I brought him back on balance. And it's just a matter of being able to have the experience and the ability to be able to do that.
Did you have signals to one another to alert one another if you felt like you were losing your balance or in serious
danger? No, because we could feel it. Mm-hmm. You can always tell when you get a hold of each other whether he's balanced or not, so we can always feel it in our body language.
Okay. Let's look at fight scenes for a second. When you're choreographing a fight scene where you'll be using martial arts, are there certain things that you think have to get into the scene, like a certain number of kicks or
no.
a certain amount of like really dazzling stuff?
No, the main thing, when I do a fight scene, I try to make it as real as possible. You know, the thing is that if I'm fighting two guys is one thing. If I'm fighting four, like in Code of Silence, I fought, 12 or 14, and I got the daylights beat out of me. You know, I didn't win because it would have been totally unrealistic for me to whip that whole bar room. And so in turn, you know, I wound up losing that fight. But that's the realism of it. If I'd have whipped everybody in that bar room, it would have been totally unrealistic. And no matter how good you are as a martial artist, you only have so much ability. And so in turn, I wound up losing that particular fight, but I tried to make it as exciting and as dramatic as I could before I got whipped.
In your autobiography, you talk about having to break the pain barrier in karate, and you've had a lot of broken bones during your years as a karate teacher and as a karate student. You have broken hands, broken noses. So what do you mean when you say breaking the pain barrier?
Well, you're able to eliminate and really ignore the pain. It's something you practice and train, and you get to a point where you're able to really ignore the pain.
Is this something you've had to practice as a stuntman too? You know, in your role as doing your own stunts?
Oh, yeah. That still doesn't mean I like pain, because I don't like pain. I'd prefer not to be hurt than being hurt. But the thing is, like in Firewalker I broke my ankle in the second week in the filming, so I had to go 8 weeks with a broken ankle. And I couldn't put a cast on because I was still filming, so I had to keep it taped through the whole movie. So it was painful, but you learn to work with it.
How do you feel about actors who have a real tough guy image but don't do their own stunts?
Well, that's fine. You know, I see nothing wrong with that. It's probably the best thing to do is not do your own stunts because, first of all, you're taking pay away from a stuntman who, that's how he makes his living, is doing stunts. And it's probably the best thing to do, and I probably shouldn't do it either, but it's right now it's kind of a thing I enjoy. I'm kind of a frustrated stuntman, I think.
Well, you kind of have to do it at this point, don't you, even if you didn't want to?
No, I don't think so. If I didn't want to, I wouldn't have to, no.
Chuck Norris is my guest. I recently saw your new movie, Missing in Action Part 3, Braddock.
Mm-hmm.
And, it's interesting. You're without a shirt during a good deal of the movie. And I wonder if that's intentional, to show off all the muscles.
No, not really, because I'm not an Arnold Schwarzenegger. But, in the torture scene that you saw, it was conducive to not have the shirt on. But
conducive to what?
Well, because I'm being electrocuted and all the stuff here. So they have to be able to see the reaction of my body being electrocuted.
Can I tell you my reaction to that scene?
Sure.
Well, just to describe it, you're being tortured by South Vietnamese, right?
North Vietnamese.
North Vietnamese.
He's from the Saigon, yeah.
Okay. And they've kidnapped your son. So you're being tortured in this cell. You're suspended by your hands. Your hands are tied over your head. And you're standing on your toes. Now, your son is in bondage in a chair in front of you, and there's a gun pointed at him. And the torturer tells you that if you step down, you're on your toes, but
right.
if your heels touch the ground and your arms lower about an inch, that this gun is going to go off.
This shotgun, yes.
Yeah, and shoot your son.
Mm-hmm.
Now, seeing you kind of writhing up there with all your muscles exposed, it struck me as almost a sexual bondage scene.
Well, is that good or bad? I don't know.
I'm not trying to put any value on it. It just struck me, and I was wondering if that was conscious or not.
No, not with me. It wasn't conscious. No, I didn't see it as that.
But
maybe the women might. I don't know.
Or some men might. I don't know.
I don't know, really, because I don't see myself as that way. So, but it's interesting you thought that way. But the thing is, what we were trying to, show the mental torture as well, because, here he is trying to force my feet down so the shotgun will go off and kill my son. So it was the tension in the mental torture that was going on as much as the physical torture, because it doesn't, work out that way.
You're the woman who plays your long-lost wife,
yes,
in the movie, I hope I'm not giving too much away,
no,
is killed
no.
off pretty quickly.
Yeah.
And I think you're frequently in movies where you don't have a romantic interest
ladies.
In it. Yeah.
Yeah, my leading ladies don't last too long in my films, do they?
Well, why is that? Are you, do you think it's part of your image to not get romantically involved?
No, not really. I think the key thing is creating an emotion that builds the whoever plays the bad role to build up him being, super bad, giving me a reason to retaliate for the atrocities that have been inflicted in whoever it is that is in the movie with me. Most of the time it's a woman.
In your movies, your character is constantly being provoked to use his martial arts skills,
mm-hmm,
and to pull out guns and knives as well. Do people ever try to take you out in real life? Have you
No.
been called on in real life to use those skills?
I've never had to use it. I've been all over the world and traveled everywhere, and I've never had anyone approach me in that respect. When you see trouble happening, you try to diffuse it before it becomes uncontrollable. And I've had to do that several times, where I've been able to diffuse a potential physical altercation before it got to that extreme. And that's part of, and the thing is, if you don't get emotionally involved and you analyze the situation of why it's happening, generally you can get out of it. And when, especially when the person realizes you're not doing it because you're afraid, but you're doing it just because you don't want the trouble. And they can feel that. They can generally get a sense of that. And when they do, then if you give them an out, then generally they will take it.
What effect do you think you've had on the American view of maleness?
God, I don't know. I don't know if I've had any effect on that respect. Because, again, I don't even think of me having a maleness type of an effect on the audience. I just play a particular type of character that I enjoy being. It was a character that I demonstrated as a karate instructor for 15 years, and I've tried to carry it on into my screen life. And a guy who's has a certain compassion for life and people, and doesn't want violence, but then he's put into a position that there's no choice but to deal with it. And we all would have to do that in our life if we're forced into it.
Well, Chuck Norris, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thanks for being with us.
You bet.
Chuck Norris, speaking to Terry Gross in 1988. He's still on the campaign trail with Mike Huckabee, and Conan O'Brien has started showing clips of Walker, Texas Ranger again. Coming up, David Edelstein reviews Cloverfield, a new monster movie for a new generation. This is Fresh Air. The new film Cloverfield is about a giant monster running amok in New York City. It has a relatively low budget, a cast of unknowns, and is directed by Matt Reeves, co-creator of the TV series Felicity. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
It has been a decade since the release of The Blair Witch Project, which was shot with one video camera from the point of view of the character holding it. The movie proved that when you eliminate the omniscient perspective, when you show the audience only what a single character sees and no more, you introduce a note of irrational terror that millions of dollars of computer-generated effects can't touch. Blair Witch was a ghost story, though, a genre in which less is always more. What if you use the same vantage for a giant monster picture, a spectacle, Godzilla through the eyes or lens of a person way down below trying not to get stomped? That was the hook of a script by Drew Goddard, which producer J.J. Abrams snapped up and turned into Cloverfield. Why the name Cloverfield? It's supposed to be the Army code word for the monster, but it's really an in-joke. As with Blair Witch, the buzz was generated by a so-called viral internet marketing campaign, and the fans' incessant prying led the filmmakers to refer to their project by the name of a street outside Abrams' West Hollywood office. The non-title seems somehow appropriate and stuck. So finally we come to the film, which centers on a bunch of attractive 20-somethings at a party in a lower Manhattan loft for Rob, who's taking a job in Japan and leaving behind Beth, the old friend he can't bring himself to tell he adores. To document the festivities, Rob's brother Jason and girlfriend Lily thrust a digital video camera into the hands of Hud, a lovable loser with a crush on a dark-eyed beauty named Marlena, who couldn't find him more boring. Hud walks around for a long time, sticking his camera in people's faces, and we wait, semi-bored, but with a tingling sense of anticipation. We listen beyond the party chatter for sounds of oncoming catastrophe. And when it comes, boom, the partygoers gather in front of the TV set.
Lil, where are you?
What was that?
What was that?
Hey, you all right?
Yeah.
You see anything?
No.
Hey, Marlena. Marlena, are you okay?
Guys, look out.
Okay.
Oh, wait, here we go.
Shut up, shut up.
Guys, come on.
Minutes after word of a possible earthquake in Lower Manhattan, nearby in New York Harbor, we're getting word of an oil tanker capsizing in the middle of the harbor near the Statue of Liberty. Once again,
weaving soap opera problems in and out of apocalyptic carnage is always a challenge, as the tinier director Roland Emmerich proved in his Godzilla remake and The Day After Tomorrow. But Cloverfield mostly gets by because the personal can't not be in the foreground. Rob is determined to get to Midtown to rescue Beth. Marlena and Lily and Jason tag along, and all of them are captured on video by Hud, who takes seriously his responsibility to document the crisis, and whose shooting is bracingly un-Hollywood-like. The actors are appealing, although at a certain point, I wish Beth gave us more of a reason to want to see her rescued than a pair of great legs. Still, if Rob and the others fled Manhattan at the outset, this wouldn't be much of a movie. As they make their way toward Midtown, the head of the Statue of Liberty flies into the street. Tanks roll by. The sky is lit by yellowish smoke. Buildings collapse in huge clouds of dust. We see the great reptilian beast for only brief instants via a swerving camera, which means our imagination fills in the rest. No scientist explains where it has come from, a government experiment, an underwater chamber. To make matters worse, it didn't come alone. It shakes off spider-like parasites that rip people up and infect survivors with something deeply icky. Of course, the notion of HUD picking up his camera after a bloody parasite attack on the group is more improbable than a giant monster flattening Manhattan, and the kid in you might crave a more objective view of the creature, not to mention the catharsis that comes from watching science and the military collaborate on bringing the monster down. That said, we've seen that monster movie again and again, and we haven't seen anything with Cloverfield's subjective sting. The devastation of Manhattan inevitably invokes 9/11, the limited vantage, an easy way for the filmmakers to exploit our newly stoked imaginations of disaster without bothering about context. So Cloverfield is a shallow exercise. But you'd have to be tougher than I am not to be blown sideways by it.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. Our digital production project supervisor is Julian Hertzfeld. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cooley.
Support for NPR comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world at macfound.org. From the NASDAQ Educational Foundation, dedicated to innovation and entrepreneurship around the world. And from the Pew Charitable Trusts, driven by the power of knowledge to solve today's most challenging problems at pewtrusts.org. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we meet actor and director Clark Johnson, who tells us about directing the pilot and several episodes of the HBO series The Wire. Join us for the next Fresh Air.